All right. Oh, that's very loud. So this is going to be one of those weird ones where the screen resolution doesn't match and I can't fix it, and I just killed my ex over trying to fix it. So this will have to do. So, yeah, I'm Peter Eisentraut. Most of you know me. I now work for F-Secure, which is a security company or an antivirus company, and we are responsible for some of those programs that make Postgres on Windows behave in strange ways. So, but we're, you know those, right? So, but we're fixing that now. So, and so The Lives of Others is actually a movie. Has anyone seen it? No. So, it's a German movie, so that's why probably not. It's about an East German government spy, as they were back then, spying on or assigned to sort of examine one of these artists, and in the process of doing so, he sort of got, you know, sort of had, was sort of intrigued by the life of the artist, and then sort of had mixed loyalties and all kinds of problems, personal problems, in deciding, you know, between his state duty and then sort of his personal interests. So by some bogus analogy, I'm that spy for the next hours, and the idea behind this is I am very interested in figuring out ways to improve community processes and development processes and so on. And last year I had a talk about how we currently do it, and this year I looked into how other projects do that and what we can possibly learn from that. And so let's see. Yesterday we had a developer meeting. I think about half or one third of you were there. So this can kind of expand on that. For those who were not there, I can sort of give you a little bit of a report on that, actually. So so this is how the slide transitions are going to work now. the rules for this, ground rules for this talk, please, you know, have a discussion with me. I don't know everything. I looked around a lot, but if you're involved in any other projects or have ideas, please, you know, just interrupt me and discuss. On the left is Comiskey Park in Chicago. I once used to sit somewhere here, so. So, the idea, how obviously there are like a million open source projects out there, right? So I wanted to look at the largest ones that are kind of like us or bigger, and then what they do, because that's kind of where we want to move. So I had this idea, you know, how do you find out who those are and how to compare them? And I had this idea I blogged about last week of using the a database that the Debian project has actually assembled. So Debian obviously has about 10,000 open source packages in there, and the Universal Debian Database is a database, a Postgres database of metadata about all that stuff in there, of package metadata basically, and you can query that and sort of figure out, you know, what people are doing. There are two flaws basically with that. There's one that doesn't count open source projects that are themselves Linux distributions or other operating system distributions such as Fedora or various BSDs or OpenSolaris. So that's kind of something you have to add on manually. But those kind of projects have kind of different issues, I believe. The other thing that is underrepresented in my whole analysis basically is Java-based projects, because they don't appear in most Linux distributions or most free software distributions for some historical or cultural issues and so on. So, but since we're not really involved in that in Java, this probably doesn't really matter for our learning experience anyway. So here's sort of how this sort of thing can work, and this is one of many queries that you can do, and I blogged about a couple of them. There were a couple of trackbacks, and people corrected my logic here. This is some completely gratuitous use of window functions out there as well, because they're actually running 8.4 beta 1 in what is kind of a production system. So, but yeah, well, it's, you know, it's for developers. So, but this is kind of my metric that I try to use. You want to look for packages that are large in terms of size of code or installation footprint, but also in terms of popularity. If you just look for large projects in terms of installation footprint, you find all kinds of scientific, numerical, like visualization packages or that have, for some reason, are really huge. So that doesn't really help us. So if you sort of multiply this, you get some something that looks realistic. And this is something you can play around with if you're the Debian developer, at least. Or you can do these sorts of analysis. Of course, you can also use, you know, package tools manually to do this, but that's not the fun database way. So here's sort of the results of that, and hopefully you can read some of this. So these are, by this metric, the, I think it's 62 biggest open source projects, and which I think is sort of fairly reasonable representation. If you look at sort of the first line, I think that's hard to dispute. Obviously, there are a lot of, you know, some faults in this analysis. For example, this makes the assertion that Apache is smaller than Postgres, which, but that's kind of, you know, obviously wrong in a sense that Apache is much more widely deployed, but the Apache code is much smaller and much simpler, I think. That's why, you know, it's down there.
That's surprising.
It's surprising, but that's you know, you saw the metric, you don't have to believe it, that's sort of the way it comes out, right? And certain other things which I found interesting, for example, this Boost, I don't know if people have used that, it appears to be a C++ library for basically anything, sort of a toolkit library, which I've not used. And It's installation count time of Debian users, which obviously this is completely, you know, you can't really rely on this. But I think it's reasonable somehow. So this is installation count times size. And, you know, you don't have to believe the order, but I think this is a good view of what are our possible role models. That's sort of what I'm getting at here. You know, it doesn't matter who's first or second in there. But I think putting OpenOffice actually ahead of Linux is reasonable. And so okay. So this is not really important, but it's just an interesting view.
This is the
installation. I was actually looking for source, but that information is hard to actually get.
The size of the install.
Yeah.
Combined with how many people
have it. Yeah. Which I guess the rationale. I don't want to really spend a lot of time on this. The rationale is, your maintenance job is harder if the code is bigger or if you have a lot more users, I think. So, I don't know. So the other thing to keep in mind is as we sort of think, you know, our processes suck, I think they are actually a lot better than other people. So, yeah. First of all, you know, it's hard to actually find out what other people are doing. So all of this is sort of my estimation of what I found out. Other projects are, you know, they're not without problems, and I think they're usually much worse. And I don't know if you people notice that, but I think people often come up to me and sort of ask, you know, how do you guys do this? It seems to work really well, and how can we sort of adopt this? And as I was working at Sun for a while, a lot of people actually, you know, came to me in this sort of capacity and asked. Yeah, Postgres project doesn't seem to have any release slip problems. How do you guys do that? So, but you know, it's all relative, actually. But you know, but the thing to keep in mind is actually our problems are not really that bad compared to other people. So here's a rundown of issues. So this is like the big one, right? So I went to you know, 62 websites, kind of, and then figured out what are these people using. So the thing that's pretty clear is that Subversion is not dead, actually, as I sort of yelled in a previous talk today. It seems to be that there's sort of I didn't want to put numbers on here because it's not going to be accurate, but it's sort of 40% Git, 40% Subversion, then everything else. That's, I think, pretty accurate. And people are still converting to Subversion now instead of, you know, doing more of the fashionable things. So, and that's I think the only one that's still using CVS is OpenOffice and Postgres. So, but obviously there's also talk into changing that. And yeah. There, everyone is thinking about migrating.
The OpenOffice
is most likely going to Mercurial, if anything, because that's the thing at Sun now. So if you see Mercurial there, that's mostly sort of Java projects or something that's sort of related to Sun and Java itself and those sort of things. And one interesting recent change, which has also been sort of publicized, is Python. They are moving to Mercurial now. And their thought process was basically, we want to have something modern, but we're not going to consider Git because it's too politically charged. And then basically they were left with Mercurial and Bazaar, and which is also kind of neat because both of those are written in Python, right? So, but that was their decision process. But basically, you know, if you look at X, Samba, even glibc, and we can sort of flip back here and... KDE is on Subversion, Firefox, I'm not actually sure. They have, I think, several things. MySQL is on Bazaar, Perl is on Git, and all of GNOME is on Git. KDE is on Subversion, I mentioned that, and so on. So that's sort of where it's going. A lot of people, a lot of projects were actually on commercial systems, such as Perl and MySQL, and then the whole Linux thing is well known, but it's kind of disappearing at the moment, because supposedly the free systems are now up to par with all the funny things you can do, and quite a number of projects actually have this sort of thing we're also doing of providing mirrors of one thing to another. So you can use both at the same time. Actually, a couple of projects explicitly sort of advertise that. So it's something interesting. Interestingly, yesterday, most people were sort of, going to go to Git eventually kind of sentiment. Nobody mentioned Subversion for us. So that's, I think, provides clarity.
Yeah. Well, we looked at Subversion, and it was just like, this is a patched version of
CVS. Yeah, which is, would also be reasonable. In my mind. Right, but that's sort of a discussion we already had. So this is sort of where everyone else is going, right? So, yeah, exactly. Well, yes, please.
One thing with the source control system is not only the source control system itself, but all the plugins you can find for all the IDs that developers are using out there. And I've been working with a lot of developers of projects, and especially with Subversion, there are still a lot of plugins that go itself. And people either just have to use a plain command line if they are real hackers,
okay. I'm not sure our community really relies on that much. Perhaps they should, or perhaps we should cater to those users, but I think we're mostly like a VI/Emacs type of group. I don't know if we should, but it's a reason why I didn't look into that. So, so on build tools, actually, it's interesting. There's basically nothing new. There was a few years ago, there was sort of this little burst in new ideas for C programs. One of those was Sconce. I don't know if people remember that, which is kind of dead now. And then CMake is actually much older, but sort of gained a little bit of popularity a while ago. And sort of the autoconf development kind of stalled, but it's kind of back now, and they're putting out new versions, fixing things. And then CMake has gotten some usage now. KDE is well-known example. KDE 4 and all the associated projects now all use CMake for everything. And MySQL actually also uses CMake for their Windows build only. They have autoconf for Unix-ish builds, and then CMake in parallel for Windows builds. But the uptake of CMake altogether is still pretty slow if you can look at that statistic there. So we had a sort of a bit of an interest last year in considering that, and then it's, if we ever wanted to go anywhere, this would be the thing. But as far as I can tell, there's basically nothing. Everyone is still using autoconf. You know, even Firefox, as far as I can tell, requires you to use all the shell tools, even if you want to build in Windows. And so that there's really nothing happening. So do you know anything, except for Stack Builder, that's not on here?
Well, I wasn't going to mention that. But I was going to ask how the packages like Firefox, which need support Windows as well, are they maintaining Visual C project files in parallel by hand as we're doing? Or?
That I don't specifically know. I just sort of, I had to do this really fast across everything. I just look what do they have and what their build instructions. So I don't know if they have any. A couple of projects have like .project files of various kinds in there. And the build instructions for I've never built Firefox myself, and I don't really use it, so I'm not really that up to date on it. But the build instructions on the website still say, you have to use autoconf. This obviously you don't have to use autoconf to build it, how it works, but you have to use the shell tools. All the Mozilla projects actually still stuck on autoconf 2.13, and they refuse to upgrade, which is why people like the Debian project have to maintain these super old versions of autoconf just so the Mozilla projects can. The latest rumor I heard is that the Mozilla group is actually working in something completely new, which is going to be in Python, and it's going to solve all their problems. But that there's there's no project page or anything I found. That's sort of, but basically we're stuck on what we have basically. So that's the upshot of this. So. Documentation tools also, people sort of wonder what's up with this doc book. That's kind of the standard, and we were actually interestingly, one of the early adopters of that, and kind of joined the winning team back then, which. Where for Postgres, I guess. So that's sort of, everyone is still using that. KDE, GNOME, all the big ones, and Samba, and all those guys, basically. And there's this sort of the debate we are occasionally having, should we switch everything to XML? Because the SGML tools are unmaintained. There are actually quite a few projects still using the SGML stuff. So we're not the last ones, basically. We will eventually be, probably, but not. So there's still a couple of dozen projects I found who are using this, so, including well-known ones such as the GTK toolkit.
We don't have to be the last ones to migrate.
Over. No, we don't. I'm just the concern is that the whole thing is completely dead by now, but it's not really so. But we're kind of, this is kind of the direction we're going, right? Eventually, we could probably going to want to move to XML. There's nothing else really available. You know about this Tesh info thing, which new projects use, but no one else is really doing that. Man pages are 50 years old and not really developing. Actually, I found one project. I forgot what the name was. I think it's Mono. They actually write the documentation in HTML. So, but they must have some tools around that. A couple of these sort of programming environments, they write their own documentation formats. So Perl Doc is kind of an extension of sort of tied into man pages, as you might know. And Qt, Qt has everything of their own. They have QMake, right, and they have their own C++ extensions. They have their own documentation format as well. Python now is requiring or using restructured text for all the module documentation. That might be something to, if we want to have a simpler format for modules or something, that might be the sort of the thing to go with now. There was a patch, if you could recall, for PSQL to output restructured text. So that's the same thing, I think. So that would be something. If you need something simpler, might be the thing to do. Okay, so discussion forums. Yeah, everyone's still using mailing lists. Everyone is using a different policy of reply to or not, so which is I am most active in Postgres and Debian, and they have completely opposite policies. And if you do it wrong, you sort of get 15 replies of do it this way. So that's really difficult. Nobody's using Usenet anymore, as far as I can tell. Of course, there are these gateways and stuff, but I have not found anything. Oh, actually, one thing I found, and what we've not really discussed or really in any serious way, is that DOF projects seem to use web forums, which kind of cater to newbies much better. We have forums. Is that what you're going to say, Josh?
No, I'm going to say one of the things that we explored several years ago for Postgres was having a list of forum gateway, because the idea being that for the newbie or the occasional user, a forum is much friendlier because they're able to subscribe to 100 posts a day mailing lists. Mm-hmm. What stopped us at the time is we couldn't make them work. There is new technology available in that seems to work fairly consistently for a number of projects.
Yeah, so this is something who is someone who is want to do web development and is not busy with GeForge might want to do that. So, but there is actually, at least for the sort of the German-speaking community, there's actually pgforum.de, which people use. That's it's obviously completely separate from all the other discussion forums, but it's used and popular, and I think also the Ubuntu project showed that forums are really useful. And then of course there's bug tracking system issue. A lot of projects do a lot of their sort of discussion through bug tracking systems. Like in the Debian project, basically you have ad hoc mailing lists pretty much for every bug, and a lot of projects work that way as well to create sort of special interest groups for a while. So. But yeah, so the bug tracking issue I don't want to sort of get into. But sort of web forms might be something to explore or sort of figure out what Josh has in mind there. Yeah, bug tracking. Well, okay, there's something about bug tracking. So basically, everyone who has a bug tracking system is using Bugzilla.
Generally, a 5-year-old version of Bugzilla.
Yeah, many of them I found. Obviously, I couldn't look into their source code, but it's quite obvious they must have like a team around it that does heavy customization on all of those. So you can sort of tell it's Bugzilla, and it's quite obvious, and they say it is, but they all look completely different, which is nice because they put a lot of work in, so it's easier for users and stuff. But using that in the way you want obviously requires some kind of team around it, a big team. So.
You don't.
So yeah. So that's the way it is. So there are a couple other sort of second place. I think is Roundup. When I looked, it's kind of for smaller projects, but it's equally bizarre to use. You have to do a lot of customization directly in Python code, and it's supposed to be upgradable, but who really knows? So Jira is a problem. It's proprietary software, right? They have this sort of allowed for open source projects, but it's not really free. So, but it's well liked. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a politically charged issue if you want to go that way. I don't know.
It seems like the distributions or groups of software like Apache, like Debian, CPAN, Apache don't use Bugzilla.
Yeah, CPAN is the third item there. They actually use RT, which is probably because it's written in Perl. Roundup is written in Python, and Python uses Roundup. Well, other projects do that as well, right? If you go to KDE Bugzilla or Red Hat Bugzilla, they handle lots of different projects.
Well, they have lots of different projects, but they're statically created, like KDE or QT.
Yeah.
Dozens of projects, but they're all centrally created.
Apparently, because some of them are missing, yeah. So. Okay, I don't know how that works, but apparently that would be an interesting consideration. Yeah. So if we had a huge team of people who want to maintain Bugzilla for us, I'm sure that it would somehow get used by someone. So I don't think we have the. I don't think the sort of the result I gathered from yesterday is that we don't even have the resources to look into that at the moment. Independent of everything else, if we want one or not in the first place, we don't have the resources, I think. So. Yeah, that's but I think there's an additional problem. We don't have the resources to do it. So, coding style is somehow, it's not really a big issue, but we occasionally have these. We had this like thread a couple weeks ago about adding VI markers to the code to indent it correctly and stuff like that. So, a coding style appears to be exclusively a problem with C and C++ because there's so many different accepted styles. Everything like Perl, Python, Java, they have like one style that the superguru once established and everyone seems to be following that. So, but there are lots of basically completely random styles. There's none that seems to be sort of established in the free software world except this GNU style, which only GNU uses and no one else. I think you guys all know that. It's kind of crazy. So, yeah, CVS keywords. We also had sort of brief discussions last couple of days. Well, nobody uses CVS anymore for the most part, so you don't find any replacements or any concerns with that, so they're pretty much gone and no one cares. Yeah, patch styles is basically everyone uses something different and it's not clear of what to use when. We have sort of a semi-written policy of using C. Other projects have somehow seem to use U all the time. And it also ties into what kind of version control system they use, because some of them can't produce one or the other very easily. So there's a complete mix of things. And so we seem to be sort of right in the middle of everything here. Wiki is, we're actually also, a little bit in the lead here with that. Not many projects have wikis. And the ones that do, not all of them really use it that much. And the ones that do, most of them use MediaWiki. There's also MoinMoin and TikiWiki that seem to be in use. I think we're sort of on a good track in expanding our usage of that. So that's all there's to that. I'm not sure what they actually use as a backend for their MediaWiki installations, though. But as some of them actually have also heavily customized their MediaWiki installations, kind of like Bugzilla, they look completely different. And you can only sort of guess from the kind of links that you see that it used to be MediaWiki. So some of them put really a lot of work into that. I think we also put some work into that to make it look.
Yeah, although Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we tried to really avoid creating any kind of report.
Yeah, the only thing I did on it was an authentication plugin. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I think it's wonderful. So the Forge Foundry issue. There are not actually a lot of those around. I only found like a dozen reasonably widely used ones. Of course, there's SourceForge, which is kind of the different thing, though. Postgres has PG Foundry. MySQL has Forge. They call it Ruby has one with Ruby Forge and Lua. The programming language Lua has Lua Forge, and those are kind of the most largest associated with the largest projects. The more common scheme, I think, at the moment is you. I tried to propose that yesterday. I don't know if people understood that really, but you have a source code repository for not only one project but basically for everything. So kind of like the KDE model, let's say, right? You have 50 different projects in one Subversion repository in that case, or Samba has 20 different projects in their Git repository, and you have one Bugzilla. And of course, in Bugzilla you can also have different projects, and then everyone has what they need, right? They have a source code and they have bugs, and that's what they need mostly. It doesn't solve the problem of having a closed mailing list for Josh, but this has sort of implications on how you manage or acknowledge your sub or sort of secondary projects. I think we're sort of doing this quite differently from what other projects do. And this is sort of an, I think, a bit of a problem that's reiterated once in a while. How do we, you know, how do we appropriately acknowledge the stop projects and so on? So I don't know. So, but I guess we sort of established yesterday that we're going to try to stick with GeForges until it completely dies. So that's what we're stuck with. All right, that's kind of the so. This picture is a commuter train station in Helsinki that I pass every day on the way to work, which is the translated name. There is actually the foundry. So I don't know. There's no foundry around there, but I found that interesting. So. Certainly, CPAN is also an alternative. I'm not really sure about the internals, but I'm not sure how well it will work for anything, but that's kind of Perl.
Yeah, so, I mean, Ruby and Python both have that, right? Ruby has the JUMP system, and Python has the AIM system. But I think the thing that is useful for all those is they're clearly language-specific,
yeah,
which is something that we can't.
And, of course, the AG system, or the what is it, the JEM system is also a packaging system and it sort of goes much farther, and then this is kind of where we want to go eventually, I think. But it's kind of a whole new system that kind of expands beyond what we need to do.
I think what made CPAN successful was not the server or the service, it was the packaging.
Right.
Yeah, so I think the direction here is clear. We need that packaging system, and then you know we can come back and see how. I think that's kind of exactly what we discussed yesterday. We need that packaging system first, and then figure out how to get the packages from A to B later.
I think one problem is that those are bad examples for us because they are language specific.
Yeah.
It makes their job easier.
Well, Postgres is kind of a language itself.
It's a platform, but even the stuff that we want to download, some of it is like modules for inside the database.
Well, those are mostly very small text files that you just download, right?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they're typically simple as well.
So, but yeah, we have had some discussion on that yesterday, and there's going to be a bit of work on packaging, hopefully. But the discussion on how to get those things shipped around has been kind of postponed. But I think something needs to be done in that area. So one thing, actually, some sort of quasi-successful projects do, they write their own tools and then sort of make them popular and do good things, right? So Samba guys wrote a number of interesting things like Zcash that I pretty much use for everything all the time. Then there's tmalloc, which is a memory allocation library, which does a bit things like what we also do, but not quite the same. But that's sort of their way to solve their problem. And this CC is also from the Samba project, which kind of goes over the top of Zcash. Bugzilla, of course, was written by Netscape, I think, even back then, to solve their problem that they didn't have a bug tracker. So,
I would actually, having done some stuff with Bugzilla, I would argue that's also their primary discussion forum.
Yeah, that's kind of, yeah, so that kind of goes back to what I said, right?
Yeah.
You just use that, which is... Well, it's Patch Tracker, we also looked at briefly, was also written by someone from the Linux kernel community to do their work. And I guess we're also having sort of a discussion now to write our own commit fast tracking tool. How is that going? That was supposed to be released today.
I was up till 1:30 and...
Yeah, okay. But you know, I think that would be a good thing to do. And of course, feedback to the build tools is useful because... Basically, the people who do this are open source developers who provide feedback to do their own work better. So we can also perhaps expose ourselves a bit better that way. So this is sort of the tools section. Now it comes to the release scheduling section. So the trend is now towards time-based release. I think that's kind of obvious. Here are a couple of examples. And so OpenBSD has been doing this forever, basically. And they sort of do it on the minute, more or less. GNOME and Ubuntu have also been doing this for a while now, and they're basically coordinating it with each other. At least that was sort of the idea in the beginning. I think now they've sort of slipped apart. Debian has been moving into that direction, trying, kind of doing the same sort of analysis 2 years ago that I'm doing now. And that kind of works out. OpenOffice has also been on this schedule of having a major release to some degree every 6 months. And I guess we're also moving in that direction. We've been sort of doing this accidentally for 10 years, and then I think there's an awareness now to do this by schedule. And the Linux kernel is kind of confusing, but they actually also have a supposed major release every 3 months. That also kind of works. Actually, MySQL people also move in that direction. That's, you know, to the extent that they ever have any sense there at all, and no one knows what's going on there now, especially, but that's their goal. And so we'll see how that works out. So that's among major projects. Obviously, small projects that have like one or two developers, they just do whenever they like it. But major projects have been going through this sort of consideration and are going this way now. I think one thing I think that's kind of unique to Postgres is that the upgrades are very hard. And so if you look at these other guys, they really don't have that much of an upgrade problem. Right? You can just install a new version and it kind of runs. And this, sorry?
That's sort of true.
Yeah.
But for example, a program like OpenOffice, you don't even have an illusion that you can just not be backward compatible in terms of reading old files.
Yeah, that's, I'm, yeah, it's. That's yeah. It's a well understood issue. It's a problem. We've lived with it for a while, for a long time. But it's understood now that we need to fix it. I'm just saying this kind of constrains us in our choices here, of how we want to schedule our releases. Because even if we said we want to have a release every 3 months, because we have really cool features every 3 months, we can't really do that, because the overhead of maintaining all these back branches and having upgrade support for everything it's not going to work. So. I just want to point out that we're in this sort of unique and unprecedented and without any comparison situation that the upgrading issue constrains us or must heavily influence the way we schedule our releases, right? And so if we ever like sort of make that work completely smoothly, we might want to consider even having faster releases. I don't know if that is useful for other reasons or not, but I'm just saying I think we're kind of stuck. Yes, Tom? Yeah, that's the other problem. It's kind of consequential because we can't upgrade anyway, and we sort of feel free to do all the other things. But I'm not sure if we ever had a smooth upgrade process, we would stop doing that or doing this differently. But
enough things are just playing wrong.
So, a lot of these, you know, if you look at something like obviously other projects are in completely different positions. If you have a new GNOME release, of course, that button's all in different places, and that's not really a problem. Or if you have a new Debian release, you have all kinds of new packages that they organize upgrades. So,
yeah, and
they have their own unique upgrade problem. Yeah, and of course, no one is here completely without problem. But I'm just saying we can't just say, oh well, what these guys can do, we can also do it, because we have very specific other problems here, right?
The other argument I'd make about not being more frequent releases is that, as it is, most of our production users skip every other version or two out of three versions before they upgrade anyway.
But isn't that because it's too much of a pain to upgrade?
Yeah, well, it's all related, right?
So.
Yeah, we're going to fix that tonight. So, yeah, but let's move ahead. I think we're sort of it's good discussion, but...
I can think of some other projects that have upgrade problems like ours.
Yeah.
Projects that use a database internal. So things like MIFTV or
I'll tell you what, projects that have those, other projects that have those problems, they fail.
So, for example, all the packages that a lot of them are configuration file changes and they need to upgrade them to newer versions. So for each package, we need to take care of the upgrade.
Okay, upgrade session right after this, right? We need to move ahead a little bit, I'm sorry. So minor releases are also pretty standard. Mostly you have a stable and a development branch. And a couple of projects have more than one back branch. Samba, for example, has like two or three, depending on what exactly time you look at, but I think Postgres has like 5, which has got to be a record, I think, so somehow. So again, this ties into all these problems we just discussed. MySQL might be the only one that comes kind of close, but there you don't really know what's a back branch and what's a forward branch or so. So they actually have like maybe 2 branches, back branches they maintain, and like 3 development branches that are going to be released like 2, 5, and 8 years from now, in theory. So they have also a lot of branching issues, I guess. But somehow, again, Postgres is in a somehow unique position there.
Do any other projects have forward branches like that?
No, and I think MySQL is trying to get rid of them, at least last time I was involved in that. But you know, I don't know what is going to happen.
The Linux
kernel has actually been moving away from that. True. Yeah, that's kind of Linux kernel is very unique in a lot of respects here. So, OpenOffice, for example, has minor releases on a fixed schedule every 3 months. So they have 6 months major releases, 3 months minor releases. It's kind of like, you know, Windows has monthly minor releases or something. So, but I didn't find any other projects that have like a fixed minor release schedule. It might be a lot of work. So as I said, OpenBSD is sort of on the clock with that. Ubuntu has tried to do it, but then they had to, at some point a couple of years ago, they had to slip because of something really important, and then they've been sort of off by a month. But they seem to also, I guess the shorter your release cycle is, the better you can plan it, of course. So doing 6 months on the minute, I think, works really well. 12 months, 18 months, now you're going to slip. So here, this is what I mentioned, projects that don't have any upgrade paths. They have problems, and that's kind of something I think we should really avoid at all costs. And we're going to change everything, or we're going to rewrite everything from scratch, or we're going to do something completely new because everything else is crap. That really fails in a lot of cases. So Samba 4 has been in development for a couple of years, and then it's still not recommended for production. And I don't really know where that's going to happen because, as I said, Samba also has like 3 stable branches in Samba version 3.something they develop. And then Perl 6, I don't know what is happening with that.
By
Christmas this year. That's, you know, it's a perfect example there, right? And then KDE 4, I guess, is sort of out now, but it's a really, really, really painful process. This is KDE 4 running around here, by the way. So, but it's a trouble, a lot of trouble. And there are other sort of historical examples, like, you know, sort of Firefox took like forever to reappear. Of course, they had other issues. And also, Python 3 is not really this. They also made big incompatible changes. At least they're shipping now, but it's going to take years until that can really be used by a wide community. And I think we've been avoiding this problem, but we've occasionally sort of had, in the far past, we've had discussions like this. You know, we're going to need to change the query tree completely. We're going to have to rewrite the whole thing and break everything. And we should really avoid that. Yeah, see, that would be one of those. I mean, it would be possibly have really wonderful effects to do that. But it's just, yeah, it's going to kill the project. That's sort of the upshot here, right? So this is my sort of little pet project at the moment, as you know from yesterday. So most projects have like beta and RC releases, and as I mentioned, the sort of the Linux model of even odd, that's, and Perl used to do that also, that's kind of dead, I think, at the moment. So no one is doing these long development branches, and then, although I guess that's kind of invalidated by the next point, because those were basically alpha releases, which is what we're kind of trying to do now. Which yeah, we're gonna do the following. We're gonna have our alpha releases 8.5 point something, and then the next stable release is 8.6, right? Is that where you want to go?
Our current beta releases, they're really miscast.
Gamma.
Gamma is alpha, beta, gamma. Gamma is general availability in MySQL terms, right? So. Well, the current progression is, or the theoretical progression is alpha, beta, and then gamma would be the release. Right? So RC doesn't really fit into that. But we've had this discussion yesterday of the naming, and there are a couple other issues like the alphabetical ordering we need to observe. And so, but we're kind of, well, I guess we're not the first, we're kind of the second. We're stealing this idea from MySQL, but this is sort of something we're going to try out and then see if other people copy us. I don't know. Okay, so here's something I was also proposing, but didn't really catch on. But some projects do that, not the whole lot, but some people have like actual release managers, which are not the project founders or anyone. So just rotating release managers.
Well, that's kind of what we have with the commit manager.
Yeah, that's kind of what my idea was to expand on that and have someone. I guess if you want to be the commit fast manager, or Josh wants to be, and you want to be his assistant, that would be wonderful, and then you can.
Well,
call yourself whatever you want to be, right? So if
Robert wants to be the commit fest manager, I'm happy to let.
Yeah, and then you can even write release manager on your business card if you want.
But we're more likely to continue to have commit fest managers for individual commit fests.
Yeah, the thing is that most of these release managers, they in order to do a good job, you have to be burned out by the end of the release, and then someone else has to do it. Right,
yeah.
So, and so people like KDE Project or Debian Project, they have these. And these are people who really basically just pester people to do certain things.
I would actually argue that in addition to the commit fest managers, we could use a release manager who is somebody who stays on top of what do we have outstanding and that sort of thing. I mean, it's sort of been Bruce's job,
yeah.
But like this time around, he was busy.
Bruce is here.
And it showed in terms of the amount of time that it took. And just the volume of stuff. Because there's an issue of, most of us can very easily get sidetracked on either minutiae or minor features or API stuff, or features that are actually for the next version. We should be closing off the current version.
The experience from having looked at some of these release manager jobs is that they also need tool support, right, to do track all those issues. So I think short-term proposal is try to do the commit fast tracking tool that we've been discussing and then try to build on that.
Did you run into any projects other than FreeBSD that has an actual release engineer?
A team as opposed to a single person? Well, the Debian project has that. That's kind of, you know, in operating system distributions, you need that. And I'm sure, you know, Red Hat and those folks, they have that. Projects run by companies have that naturally, somewhat naturally, I guess. Beyond that, probably not really. Yes, please.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's what we're building now, I think. I hope it's going to be built. Just a commit fast tracking tool, and then you just change commit fast 123 to release ABC, and that might help. So that's something to work on, I think. But it's not every project really has that. In a lot of projects, it's basically by sort of tradition, people who've always done it try to do it. That's what most people do. So downstream packaging, I think we've been doing a really good job now. We sort of know every package or individually, and we tell them per package, and then they do it, and that's really works really well. And that is sort of an idea. I think as far as I'm concerned, you stole from KDE, or I stole from KDE and then proposed, or then someone did it. I don't know, but that's my personal inspiration. And I've been doing Samba packaging for Debian for a while. They also do that really well, communicate and have people on both lists and that sort of thing. So other projects just basically do it randomly, or the couple of problem cases like OpenOffice or various Mozilla projects where sort of the packagers have to fight with upstream on which changes are allowed and which changes and you go away and why don't you download our binaries, and then basically, OpenOffice has now been forked by a couple of Linux distributions, and then the Mozilla projects, they have trademark issues and all this sort of problem. So I think we're doing quite excellent on this.
Peter?
Yes?
So, when you say packaging region, we do have sort of a packaging team.
Yeah.
Packages go out, but I've always thought we're pretty open as far as what and how you package that. Yeah, Debian clearly has different packages, Red Hat.
That is something I don't think we can fix or want to.
I'm not sure it's a problem we want to solve. Just we're in the tight end.
I don't think anyone solves that any better. Maybe that's of course if you build your tarballs in a way that there's only one logical way to install it, then it works much better. Like in KDE, for example, there's not really much you want to do. But Samba, for example, is the same situation. You can just basically put this there and this there and so on. Yes, Chris. Well, it's basically we know those people and they know us versus everyone just downloads tarball and does whatever they like with it versus download the tarball and does whatever they like in spite of protests by the upstream team. That's sort of the progression, right? We could do better in terms of telling people to put stuff in common locations, but the problem with that is basically we've lost that game 10 years ago and now we can't change people to, oh, why don't you change your path to this because the other people also do it that way. It doesn't help anyone. Greg had a question.
I think we do very well and the final product's very good, but my question is, are those people packaging, the downstream packages, expending more energy than they should have to do it?
I think the answer to that is that could certainly be improved. Tom, as one of the affected...
My comment is I think it's more or less happenstance that we are doing it that way, arising out of the fact that a lot of people who are actually doing packaging happen to be members of or closely interested in the project.
Well, I recall the history actually differently. We specifically said we need to change something and created a packages list and invited and somewhat forced these packages to sign up. That's the way I recall it.
Well, but the point is
somewhat. I guess we sort of did it at the right juncture to make it better, yes.
The Debian packager used to be pretty out of the post-production.
Yeah.
And there's some people on the packagers list who I really don't know much about, except there are packager for some obscure variety of Linux.
I'll always have those. Obscure Linux distributions have obscure packagers with obscure packages, so I don't know. Is this something like you mean it's better now than it was before?
No, there are some packages where the Debian packager is a third-party person packaging up software that's out there on the internet. And there are other packages where the packager is...
And you mean Postgres is one of those better ones, or
yeah?
Okay, yeah, yeah. That's.
It works much better than the way we have it.
And if you compare a Debian package from now to, you know, 8 years ago, now there are like 12 patches in there, and most of them are path changes, and there used to be not even a patch, but the different code in there, basically, right?
Is that gone? Those changes are gone.
Oh, it's much better now. Yeah, so. We could make it easier for people to even, you know, produce consistent packages, but again, we can't really change what people have already done, so that's difficult. Security handling is, I think we also have done good changes in the past, and we're sort of in the lead there. In most big projects, you can go, you know, send security problems here. Most are using Bugzilla, even have a warning on their front page, you know, don't send security problems into this Bugzilla, but send them there instead. So that is usually handled. CVE numbers we're using, those are standard. One issue I've observed is that a lot of sort of people who deal with security problems have a different view of what is important and not than people who have work on databases. For example, you know, basically this whole security making, you know, security contacts and security teams and so on was built back when, you know, Bind and Sendmail were the most popular open source projects, and basically you had to fix buffer overflows all the time, and that, for databases, this doesn't really apply. Of course, you still want to fix those, but those are not the top issues, right? Because database is usually hidden behind three layers of other stuff, and most buffer overflows you can't really exploit anyway. More important are problems of data loss and this sort of thing, and then many security people in especially Linux distributions have had a hard time understanding our point of view on that. And then we've been sort of, we just sort of barely have some of them now at that point that they actually believe us when we put out a new minor release that, you know, does not fix buffer overflows or security exploits, but, you know, data loss issues. I used to have those sort of the saying for myself, you know, Debian stable means it just keeps doing the same thing, but it's not actually stable software in terms it doesn't lose your data. So it's better now, I think. So committers. There's always, you know, we need to add more committers and stuff. Actually, a lot of projects seem to do with very few committers, which is amazing somehow. But, you know, if you look at projects like Samba, they don't have like 100 committers. They have like, I don't know, 3, 4, 5. Of course, now they're using Git, so you don't really know who's committing what, where, how.
No, but there's merges.
Yeah, but, you know, we don't really know. Like, you can commit there and then someone else merges it there. I don't know. But a lot of projects have, you know, not, you know, dozen or 2 dozen committers, and that's it. Even OpenOffice, for example, they don't have hundreds of committers. Then on the other hand, you have some projects that have, you know, hundreds or even thousands of committers or uploaders. Most of those are operating distributions or KDE projects, which I keep bringing up because I've followed that for 10 years, basically. Basically, there you can just say, you know, write to some email address, say, I want to work on this particular obscure piece of software that's sort of not maintained right now, and then you get a commit account. So you just have to ask for it, basically. I think that sort of has to do with the way the software architecture is. You know, like in KDE or Debian, for example, you can work on your own little piece of thing without any hurting anyone else, usually, and that works. In Postgres, you kind of have to go through everything affects everything, which is unfortunate, but that's kind of the way it works. So you have to go through some kind of central committee that has an overview of everything. It's a scalability problem, really, but that's kind of a software architecture problem in general. Of course, we have sort of PG Foundry, which kind of expands our theoretical base of people who do things. Sort of running out of time really quickly here. So I think we're sort of in the average here, but it's a scalability issue. So let's sort of move a little bit quicker here. So project steering is kind of overvalued, I think. There's a lot of these, you know, GNOME Foundation, KDE Association, and software in the public interest, and those sort of things. But they don't really look. Some of them seem to be more active than software in the public interest, but I think they don't really. They just collect money and make marketing. So I don't think really you need to do a lot of things here. There's still forks happening, actually. And so there are a couple of recent examples, actually. So if this GoOO website is actually a fork of OpenOffice, which some Linux distributions are actually using as their source of OpenOffice now. So if you use SUSE or Debian, for example, you don't get Sun's OpenOffice, but you get basically what is Novell's OpenOffice fork, actually. Latest thing is eglibc, which is actually a fork of glibc, which is, you know, I found incredible, but it's what Debian is using now, as of right now, actually, on this laptop here. Our Delta is one of many forks of MySQL, and then Diceweasel is forked by Debian because of trademark issues. So, you know, it still happens. If you don't do your homework and if you piss off your partners and or downstream or upstream people, forks can still happen. So that's, you need to stay on top of things. And no one is immune from this, not even, you know, glibc or OpenOffice. Of course, somehow we have a lot of commercial forks in database land, which I guess as long as it's sort of commercially viable, I guess that's true, but it's interesting. Licensing, you think after 20 years of open source, people would have figured this out, but there's still a lot of problems. And some of distributors are incredibly picky in all their very specific ways, like Fedora or OpenBSD or Debian. They all have their very specific problems. And commercial companies also have legal departments that actually seem to read licenses once in a while. And so keeping this sane is really important. And there have been really prominent cases of problems in the past. And you know, many of those have been fixed. But, you know, X386, for example, projects pretty much dead right now because they changed the license, right? And OpenSSL is not sure what's going to happen to that. Fedora wants to replace it now, and then Debian might want to follow suit and this sort of thing. We've had our little share of problems with GPL, both in contrib and leaking in the wrong libraries and that sort of thing, so we do have to stay on top of that. This is not, we're not perfect on this either, and everyone can be affected by this. Copyright notices is not really important. Some people have like really standard copyright assignments and notices. Other projects do like us. We just sort of put a fake PostgreSQL global development group, which doesn't really exist, and it just says, you know, there's someone who wrote this, basically. And some people like, you know, KDE, they just write whoever wrote the code, and that's it. Python, actually, I looked, they have absolutely nothing in there, which is also something to consider. So, funds management, we're also sort of in the middle of this. As I said, some of those projects have these super GNOME foundations and so on. They are basically just bank accounts. So I think we're doing okay with this for the moment. So let's see. This is sort of the last one. This is sort of, I just added that. Open source software can participate in standards organization. It's sort of been a problem, or it sort of didn't really know how to do that, but I think we can do this now. And, you know, basically, POSIX standard is now being written by glibc authors mostly. OpenOffice has created standards, and I think also the Open Desktop Free Desktop has done useful work. And MySQL is now in the SQL standards committee, and maybe we should be too. So I think we're so. So this is how an average open source project looks nowadays. So there's still a lot of stuff written in C mostly, or in Java. GPL is still the most common license. Everyone is moving to Git. Everyone is using Bugzilla. People are still using Otacon for everything. You know, regular releases are really useful. And as for what we can do, open issues for us are version control system we've discussed, might want to do something. Web forum we should follow up on. Bug tracking system, I mentioned we don't have resources for that, don't know what to do with that. CMake might be something in the future if we really get pissed off.